Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel, and today we have a repeat guest on the show in Mr. Daniel Wisefield of Three Pillar Communities. Before we dive in, I want to cut a deal with you. If this episode adds more than $100 in value to you, which I'm sure it's going to add way more than that, would you mind taking 30 seconds to leave a review? This helps us get more listeners, and it literally lights me up when I see a new review on the podcast. So thank you for taking the time to leave that review. All right, let's dive in. Daniel Wisefield is a third-generation mobile home park owner, operator, who grew up fixing porches and mowing lawns at his grandfather's mobile home parks on the West Coast in California and Washington. He has a JD and an MBA from Yale University and is also a licensed attorney in the state of California. Since Daniel was last on the show, which was October of 2020, which is a weird time with COVID and everything, but since then, Three Pillar Communities, their portfolio has grown a lot. They went from just under 30 communities in five states and just under 3,000 lots to more than 70 manufactured housing communities across 14 states, now serving over 10,000 residents with over 120 employees. Daniel Wisefield, welcome back on the show, brother.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. For those first-time listeners, would you mind briefly just reminding them of your story and sure. You know, going in and how you got into investing in mobile home parks?
Of course. So I come from a pretty scrappy immigrant family. My mom was born on a chicken farm in Israel. So was my grandfather. And they got sick of being poor farmers and they immigrated to the US around 45 years ago. And my grandfather was a car mechanic. He fixed cars. And I'd go help him in the summers, you know, straighten out bumpers, go work in the paint booth. And he saved money from that. And he bought a mobile home park around 30 years ago. So, you know, my family were mom and pop operators. You know, if a pipe broke, my grandfather was out there digging up a ditch and fixing it. And I did not plan to go down that path. I, you know, went to fancy schools and I pursued a typical kind of corporate career path. And at some point I was in my early 30s, I had our first baby at home, thinking, what am I doing with my life? What am I really solving for? And I decided to quit corporate life and become a real estate investor. And I decided to focus on mobile home parks because it's such an incredible way to provide high quality, affordable housing, really impact our residents' lives, and also get really long-term durable returns.
Awesome. What an awesome story. You guys have grown a tremendous amount over the last 3 years. So I'd like to start there and talk about, you know, what your strategy has been on new acquisitions to build a portfolio of over 10,000 lots.
Sure. So we started out in our region, or I think that's pretty normal. You start out in your backyard. And then we were growing in California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Arizona. And at some point we realized, hey, we are really product experts. We really understand mobile home parks. We are not local geographic market experts. So we could take this product expertise and apply it across the whole country, right? There's no reason why we shouldn't go look at deals in the Carolinas or Florida or Texas or Ohio or anywhere else. And really the big unlock for us about 2 years ago was bringing on our new chief operating officer, Corey Wickstrom. He's a guy who's been in the mobile home park industry for about 20 years. An incredibly talented operator. He's worked for three or four other mobile home park companies. And he has, you know, overseen hundreds of parks all over the country, built teams of thousands of people. And once he joined our team, that gave us really the confidence to go out and start sourcing deals all over the country. So we have been actively growing in the Carolinas. We've bought, I think, 12 or 13 parks there in the past year or so. Actively growing in Texas. We're now operating, I think, six parks in Texas. And, you know, we invest up and down the risk spectrum within our asset class. So we will buy really nice stabilized properties. We do a lot of value add. And we're also developing some new mobile home communities on raw land. Wow. And by the way, I should be saying manufactured housing communities. It doesn't roll off the tongue as well. So I keep on slipping back to the old nomenclature. Forgive me for that.
Totally. Yeah. There's land lease communities. There's, you know, manufactured housing communities. Some people call them trailer parks, mobile home parks. But that's very interesting that you guys are going up and down the risk spectrum from development all the way to, you know, buying stabilized stuff. Is this all through a fund facility that you guys are doing this? Is there multiple funds?
We've done it different ways. We started out syndicating deal by deal.
Okay.
We then raised and fully deployed two funds. One was in 2020 and one was in 2022. And at this point, we are back to raising deal by deal. Our deal flow is a little bit slower right now. Partly that's because of interest rates and pricing, and partly that's by design. We bid off a lot in fund two, and we've got a lot of heavy turnarounds all at once. And we realized, hey, let's not grow for the sake of growing. Let's fix what we own, you know, digest these projects that we took on and grow more slowly. So for that reason, we're not raising another fund right now. We're just acquiring deal by deal.
That's smart. Yeah, that's kudos for being able to say, hey, let's just slow it down. Let's perfect what we have. I think all too often you see, you know, operators and sponsors get all caught up in acquisitions and just kind of fly off the rails. And, you know, it's always good to kind of just take a step back and say, all right, where are we at? You know, that's good.
Yeah, Andrew. So let me turn the table on you.
Yeah.
I know that you pursued self-storage in addition to mobile parks. And I think you had a realization that it wasn't the right fit for you and you might have pivoted, which takes a lot of courage. So yeah,
very similar type of situation, right? It was like, you know, we got into self-storage. We probably should have, you know, bought one or two and then just slowed down and really figured out the operations, but we kind of were overconfident and kind of ran in and bought up 11 of them in 2021. And we got really good deals, you know, buying them off market direct from mom and pops. And, you know, out of the 11, four of them just were like completely like in a very tertiary market. And we've just struggled with operations to like figure out. It's more price sensitive, you know, kind of like a commodity versus mobile home parks where it's more longer term tenants that are a little bit stickier. So yeah, same type of thing. We paused acquisitions. We've sold some of the assets and decided to kind of, you know, moving forward, focus on MH. It's just been a better fit for us.
Yeah. Was it hard for you to swallow your pride and communicate that message to your LPs?
I didn't think so. It kind of is what it is, you know, like, you know, I don't know. I guess from talking to some other operators and some other like LP advisors, our investor updates are pretty straightforward. Like, you know, your NOI versus projected, your revenue versus projected, yeah, your distributions versus projected. So like everybody kind of knew like, hey, this isn't going as we thought it would on these mm-hmm. four that are kind of struggling, not kind of struggling, like definitely were struggling. So it was just kind of very a humbling experience. And I go back to Poor Charlie's Almanac. And I think about like, you know, getting outside of your core competency. Yeah. And Charlie's always like, you know, you got to be careful because, you know, stick to what works. And I just remember that reading what I was reading in that Poor Charlie's Almanac, where he's like, hey, don't get overconfident. I think a lot of people get over their skis, and that's a prime example. So yeah, that's where we're at.
You know, one thing I've observed in manufactured housing is investors in this asset class, particularly new investors in this asset class, fall in love with the asset class story and forget the first rule of real estate, which is location, location, location. Mm. Would you say that happened to you with these self-storage deals?
I think it did. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the four are in a tertiary area, but the, you know, the other seven that we owned did well, but we also came to realize the reason why we're selling them off is that it takes a lot of time to master operations, right? Yeah. And it doesn't just happen overnight. Yeah. So when we realized, hey, this is a bigger fish, and we tried to hire someone that was like a regional manager at one of the big storage REITs, thinking that they could kind of come in and help us establish a good management company that was for self-storage. And they kind of just came in and wet the bed. And it was like a very bad experience. And so it was like, let me take the reins over. So, literally the last year, I would say like 80% of my time is going towards like managing those directly. Like I'm that managing the management company. And so, yeah, it's been interesting because I just think of the trade-off of, hey, where could I be spending this time growing the portfolio on the MH side of things and it being more scalable. So yeah, definitely a learning experience that I won't make, you know, that mistake again.
Yeah. Makes sense. And how many parks are you operating now?
We have 43 parks now, just about 3,000 lots. So about when we spoke last time, you know, about your size is kind of where we're at. And it's spread out, you know, all from the Midwest to now the Southeast. But yeah, I don't know. I don't have ambitions of getting to 10,000 lots in the next 3 years.
Can I ask, am I hijacking this too much or can I ask you another question about Keel Team?
No. Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. So in my mind, one of your strengths that I always admired about you when you were starting, at least, was you had a ninja operations team, a lot of people, mostly former athletes, who you'd send them out as like a SWAT team to your new acquisitions, live on site, turn stuff around. Are you still maintaining that as you've grown, or has it gotten a little more corporate, a little less ninja?
Yeah. So we're still doing that. We still have, you know, our Keel Team 6, you know, our project managers.
Keel Team 6. I didn't realize that. Cool.
They'll go out at least the first, you know, few weeks, you know, depending on how big of a project it is, and they'll be living on site. So we have a couple big projects going right now, and yeah, we have people on site that have helped us. But, you know, I think if a project only has like, you know, two or three vacancies that we're trying to fill, you know, we'll be on site to kind of, you know, facilitate the transfer of ownership and kind of get on our new systems with, you know, pay lease and things like that, you know, for the first few weeks. And then we'll back away and kind of manage it remotely. But on the big stuff, like we have a project with 50 vacant homes, 50 vacant park owned homes that we just bought a few months ago. And, you know, someone's on site, you know, multiple crews managing the renovations on these, just because it's just the cost savings. It definitely is worth it. So. Yeah.
Do you have physical construction and rehab people on your payroll who you send around, or are you typically using contractors?
Using third-party contractors. Yeah. You know, at this point though, you know, we have like a couple crews that have traveled with us, you know, from deal to deal just because of, hey, you know, you want a bunch of work, you know, come up here in Michigan. We have 50 spots, you know, or their home base is around Indianapolis where we had several parks. So it's worked to kind of build those relationships, and same with some transporters and things like that as well.
Cool.
Yeah. But I know you guys got into a little bit of RV parks. Is that correct with part of the fund?
Yeah. At this point we own around 80 parks, and I would say probably 10 of those are RV parks.
Okay.
We are bullish on long-term stay RV, and we'll continue to buy long-term stay RV, which we can operate pretty much like our manufactured housing communities. Mm-hmm. We experimented with a couple of recreational RV parks and realized that we are really not the right operators for those. And so kind of similar to your self-storage story, you know, we own one of those now in Southern California where, you know, it'd be nice to sell it, but we got to fix it before we sell it or else we're going to lose money. And we've been very transparent with our investors about that. And so we are in the weeds, hands-on, working to raise occupancy, improve NOI, do all the things so that we can have a successful exit.
Nice. Yeah, I think it's not the best time to sell either with rates where they're at. But earlier today, I interviewed Scott Medelsky, who's like a finance loan broker. And he was mentioning, you know, the Fed's kind of temperament and who knows where they'll go, right? But some seem to think that in the next 6 to 12 months, there might be some, you know, some rates dropping, but we'll see.
One of my smartest investors tells me, you know what? Your real estate GPs are all the same. You always think rates are going to drop 6 to 12 months from now.
Optimistic.
Which right? I think is actually a really good feedback. And it's true. If you look at most people's underwriting model, it's like, well, interest rates are 7% now, but when we go to refi 2 years from now, they're going to be at 5%. Based on what, right? Yeah, there are all sorts of indications now that even with rates where they are, we still have inflation above target. And I don't necessarily see the Fed dropping anytime soon. Not that I know, not that I pretend to predict what the Fed will do, but I think all we can do as dumb real estate investors is accept how much we don't know and plan for the downside.
Yeah. And work on operations, right? That's something we can control for sure. Maybe you can touch on that actually. Like, how have you guys on your most recent acquisitions, you know, the last few years with higher rates? How have you guys pivoted around that to still get deals done?
I'd say it's probably two things. One is getting more proactive about off-market deal sourcing. I'd say almost all the deals we've acquired have been off-market in some sense, but in our early years, we were relying on brokers to bring us that off-market deal flow. And in more recent times, we've gotten more proactive about going direct to sellers.
So how have you done that? Yeah, how have you built those relationships off-market?
A lot of it is through industry relationships and building relationships with other park owners as a fellow park owner. I think they get a lot of cold calls from people who are just cold calling and don't actually know the business. But if you can go talk to folks, hey, you know, we own all these parks in your area. Here's what we're doing on management. Here's what we're doing on operations. How can I help you with your problems? That goes a long way, right? Like, I think people get a phone call, hey, do you want to sell your park? And it's typically no. But if it's, hey, we're dealing with the same issues you are, how can we put our heads together? It's a different conversation. So that's one thing on kind of the deal sourcing side. And then secondly, I'd say we've been doing more value add and development because buying the stabilized stuff has gotten pricier and harder for us to make it pencil with elevated interest rates. So I think a good example is we bought a $50 million portfolio in the Carolinas about 10 months ago now, nine parks. And it is kind of a classic class C portfolio of manufactured housing communities. We're serving people in the workforce, mostly older single wides, not amenitized. You know, it got some holes in the roads. You've got some utilities that need repair. And you had about 20% vacancy. And so we are happy to take on a project like that, roll up our sleeves. We're going to bring in, I think, around 80 brand new homes, rehabbing existing homes that are there. We've already installed playgrounds, fixed utilities, put new roads in. We've deployed about $2.5 million in capital improvements so far. So we love that, right? We love a project like that. And that's kind of where we can still, I think, compete effectively, even when we can't buy the stabilized class A community in, you know, a coastal market.
Totally. No, that's awesome. Yeah. And especially if you're able to get scale with a $50 million portfolio, that's huge. That's really cool. Tell us about, you know, ground up development with mobile home parks. I've seen your project.
It's hard. Bozeman. That's the answer. It's hard.
I would imagine so. You know, yeah. I just know, you know, that project in Bozeman, what a great market. You know, how has that progressed and what other new development projects are you guys working on?
Yeah. So I'm happy to share that we have moved in our first new homeowner in Bozeman at our Cameron Crossing project. We handed over the keys last week.
Congrats.
So this is a project where at the beginning of COVID, we said, hey, we'd really like to build brand new manufactured housing communities. Let's pick a target market. We picked Bozeman. We found 90 acres that belonged to a farmer. I flew out there, met Mr. Dykstra. He was out there on his tractor. We shook hands, made the deal. We bought 90 acres. That was alfalfa fields. And I think we closed on the land in 2021. Since then, we got it entitled. We got it engineered. We put in all our infrastructure. We put in a sewer lift station. We built a turn lane coming off the highway. All these things now, you know, just takes 2 seconds to talk about it. But each of these things is hundreds of hours of work, right? Like that darn turn lane and dealing with the State Department of Transportation. Like each one of these things is hard. And we're finally now at the point where we have 24 homes on the ground. We have our sales center is open and we are selling. So pretty exciting. We're selling brand new homes in the range of $200,000 to $270,000.
Wow.
These are pit set with a garage and a concrete driveway, nice backyard. And this is in a market where single family homes are typically selling in the $600,000 to $900,000 range. So we're providing huge value. You can't buy a condo or a townhouse anywhere close to these prices. And we're selling a brand new, you know, 3 or 4 bedroom home with a garage and a private backyard for under $250,000. It's incredible value.
Totally. And I guess with that, right? Because like you said, it has, you know, paved driveways and everything. How do you, like, with infill, right? To like count on the income that's coming from all the expenses and things like that. Like, how do you plan for that? That would be my concern, is just like, okay, how many sales are we going to have per month? And obviously Bozeman's, you know, booming, but yeah, how do you estimate returns around that?
Yeah. So we, first of all, we strongly believe in a for sale model. There are other operators who will bring in new homes and rent them out as park-owned home rentals, which is a much faster way to get tenants in and start getting income. But we really strongly...
I'm one of them.
Okay.
I brought in, I think it was, 40 brand new homes. I sat on them for 3 months. We sold like two. And I was like, let's rent them all. Let's just get some income in here. I did that on a project.
And you rented them all out. And they're probably in 2 months, you were
all
full
of them. And we were full very quickly. So,
okay,
but
so tell me about that. So were you happy to rent out your brand new homes?
No, I didn't want to rent them out. I guess my test dad that I had live.
Yeah.
I didn't go deep enough into the creditworthiness of the tenants and their ability to, execute on, fully buying them. I just kind of, we took their information, counted. We had 25 leads, I think, in a week. And we're like, okay, we can sell some homes here. Well, it turns out, that it's not the best home sale market. So I'm curious, with your market, how you guys have estimated that.
Yeah. So we basically projected 6 sales a month. That is based on the size of the market and how competitive we thought our product would be and our capacity to actually bring his homes in, set them up and sell them.
Gotcha.
I think if you had an incredible assembly line for setting these homes up and an incredible, well-trained sales team that you could turn on at the snap of the fingers, we could probably sell more like 10 a month. And I think if we really screw it up and we are incompetent, we'll still sell probably 3 or 4 a month just because the product sells itself.
Because of the big difference between median home price.
The quality of what we're bringing in and the price point. Those were all estimates that we had to make before investing many millions of dollars. And they are not entirely scientific, but they are based on our experience in similar markets.
Nice, nice. And it's going well. We're selling 6 plus a month.
Well, we just got our certificate of occupancy about 4 weeks ago. And that's what really lets us, start the sale process. Mm. I think we're ramping up to 6 a month. We're not quite there yet. It's interesting. We've had probably 40 home reservations where people put down a deposit and then ended up canceling because the homes weren't ready yet, right? It's been over the course of the past 18 months.
And
so
they needed it. Yeah, the timeline.
It's only now that we're finally going to start getting the momentum. I think we actually have, homes people can move into and buy.
Gotcha. And is it you're bringing the homes in, setting them up, and then selling them there? You're not like letting them choose a home and then bring that in? It's just...
So we're actually doing both. So I think some of your listeners may not fully appreciate that having a vertically integrated manufactured home dealership is a key part of this business if you want to be a good operator, particularly in a product like our Bozeman neighborhood where, this is a Class A manufactured housing community. We're going to have walking trails and a dog park and a clubhouse. And we're targeting customers with a household income of, let's say, $70,000 to $120,000. And so we want to control the process and the quality of the product, make sure it looks good. So we are bringing stuff in ourselves through our dealership and installing it. That being said, in addition to all the inventory homes we're bringing in, we also will work with customers to do custom home orders, again, through us, kind of through using our quality specifications.
That's fantastic. And yeah, what tips could you share with our listeners? What don't we know about that process?
I just think generally don't believe the hype about mobile home parks. Mm. That's my general idea. You read a lot of stuff on the internet saying mobile home parks are the best kind of real estate to own because it's like owning a parking lot, right? Like your tenant owns their home and they pay you lot rent forever and you don't have to do any work. And that couldn't be further from the truth, as you know and as I know. These are communities that require very active management. Many times they were built 50, 60, 70 years ago and a failing infrastructure require a huge capital injection. And if we're going to keep these communities as a viable source of affordable housing for the next coming decades, it takes a hands-on operator to come in and improve them. And a lot of times you have homes that were built before the federal HUD code went into effect in 1977. that are, you know, weren't built to modern safety standards and might be nearing the end of their useful life. So if you're a hands-on operator, you got to go in, replace old homes, rehab homes, fill vacant lots, rebuild utilities. And that's just part of the job. That's something, you know, that you and I do every day. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't appreciate.
No, that's a huge point is active management. And there's been other operators that have struggled because of that exact piece. When it comes to ground up development, though, is it just having that, you know, same approach, just having that hands-on process, like you're talking about the turning lane, all these different hurdles, and just really trying to just have that high sense of urgency, you know, to kind of push the.
So I will say, again, in my limited experience, I don't want to pretend I'm a master developer because I've only broken ground on one of these. But in my limited experience, what I've learned from this one project, number one, you need an expert land developer, right? Don't try to learn that yourself. I'm not going to try to learn that myself. There's an entire skill set that is, you know, absorbed over decades of experience of someone who can look at raw land and say, hey, how do I turn this into a built product? And it requires a creative mind and a vision. And it also requires an engineering and a land use mind. And so I brought on a partner who's a master developer. He's built skyscrapers. He's built subdivisions to lead our land development efforts. That's number one. And so my partner, Dean, kind of took it from raw land through concept, approvals, engineering, design, infrastructure in the ground. Okay. Then the second key piece in these developments is sales. You better have a good process to order your homes, finance your homes, get your homes installed, get them advertised and marketed, get them sold to the end customer. And that means getting your end customer appropriately connected with channel finance. If you are just bringing, you know, if you're just like hanging up a for sale sign and hoping people show up, guess what? They're either not going to show up, or if they do show up, they're not going to get financed, because manufactured housing financing is a very unique type of financing. And so I have two full-time employees on my team who just work to get our customers financed. And we're not getting paid as a mortgage loan originator for that. We just do it as a service, as a free service to our home buyers. It helps them get a home loan, and it helps us get our homes sold to qualified customers.
Very cool. Yeah. Another benefit of scale. You know, you have a team that you can afford to have people just hold people's hand through that process. So that's exactly. Great. Daniel, if you were going to passively invest as an LP with another mobile home park operator, what are the major items that you would look at to try and get comfortable with the deal?
Well, I'd want to make sure that the operator was like a marathon runner, a family man, extremely good looking, and had like an in-house like Delta Team 6 that he can deploy across the country.
Do you know anyone?
But beyond that, realistically, I would want someone who has tried and failed and learned from their lessons.
That's good.
I think I'm a much better investor now that I have made mistakes and I have learned what not to do. And so if I had, you know, limited capital, I could only invest with one operator, I'd want it to be someone who's made mistakes and can tell you about those mistakes and what they learned.
That's good. And a lot of people say, hey, you know, look at the track record, but I like that. You know, what are your mistakes? If you don't have mistakes, that's a red flag, right? Wouldn't you say that's a red flag?
Either you haven't been doing this long enough, or you're not being transparent about your mistakes.
Yeah.
Because if you're doing deals at scale, they're not all going to be good.
Exactly.
And I think mistakes probably fall into two main buckets. One is underwriting mistakes. You thought it was going to be great, but you made a mistake. You never should have bought the thing. And the second are execution mistakes, right? There's a chance to make it good, but you weren't able to get your act together. And candidly, we have made both types of mistakes. Both of those. I am guilty. And it has made it better.
And so have I. Yeah. And I think every deal gets a little bit better, right? And now, I was talking with someone earlier, you know, now I had a due diligence debrief meeting today. We're on an active deal that we're working on. And we were able to go so granular that, like, when we first got started, you know, we were just, you know, using the 30-day due diligence handbook we got from the MHU bootcamp. But now we're going so granular into, you know, cameraing the sewer lines and just so much other stuff that it's like, I feel way more comfortable now because, again, we have that scale, right? Where I'm sure yours is a whole nother level of scale where you can get really granular with it. But if you're just a new operator, you know, you can figure it out, but it's just that much harder without that additional help. So what are some of those mistakes that you've made?
I would say, first of all, we had made the mistake of concentrating our portfolio in markets that are not friendly to landlords. Mm. And during COVID, we suffered, particularly in places like Washington, where we had certain tenants who didn't pay rent for 24 months. Mm. And the government said that was okay. And we actually were at risk of losing one of our properties because we couldn't cover our debt service. And, you know, state law said, sorry. So that was kind of a strategic mistake around where we were allocating our efforts. We have bought properties and completely underestimated how much capital we required to fix them up and overestimated how quickly we would lease them up. Mm. I'd say that was a problem in Fund 2, which is our most recent fund. I said we've got a lot of heavy projects there that we're working on kind of digesting and fixing. And basically in Fund 2, we bought 12 properties in Fund 2, and 8 of those are like heavy value add. We took them on all at once. Mm-hmm. And we projected that we would be delivering positive distributions to our investors by month 6. That was wrong. That was bad underwriting on our part. I think we didn't, particularly in the case of park-owned homes, you should just always assume every park-owned home you look at is going to be worse than you think. It's always the rule. It's always worse than you think. So we bought a bunch of park-owned homes. Yeah. They all required a ton of more rehab money than we thought. Some of them we had to demolish because they were uninhabitable. We're now working away. You know, we've done the fixing and now we're kind of reoccupying those properties. So that was bad underwriting. And then finally, I'd say we made the mistake of not having the right people on the ground to execute a plan. Particularly if you're trying to do infill and raise occupancy, it requires a very proactive manager. Not all managers want to sell. Some managers want to just focus on managing and execution. Nothing wrong with that. It's just a different type of personality. And we built systems and process to try and make sure all of our managers are doing the sales stuff and doing the occupancy stuff. But if someone's not wired that way and doesn't want to do it, you're not going to get the results. And it's been amazing how we'll have a property where we're struggling to raise occupancy and then we change managers and all of a sudden it's like flicking a light switch.
Yeah. Yeah. I've noticed that too. Same situation. We had a property in Michigan and the boots on the ground manager was a great like property manager, right? Very diligent, very strict, but was not selling well. So we went to like a local realtor and we said, hey, you know, we'll pay you a commission to sell our homes. And the showings like went off the Richter scale and we were getting way more applications. Because she had a bubbly personality, she was, you know, encouraging, you know, the call to action, right, to fill out the applications. So I agree that there's little tweaks like that that you just have to watch, and it can, you know, be game changing. So
yeah,
thanks for sharing those with us. What would you say about the ground up development? You know, like what would you say if you were going to invest passively into a ground up mobile home park development? You know, what would be like the major items you'd look at to get comfortable investing in that deal?
So let me say something cynical. I would only invest in a ground-up development in a market where the median single-family home price is more than $500,000. Mm. Otherwise, you're fighting an uphill battle. And it's a lot of work, and it's hard, and there's no guarantee that people will choose your product as opposed to something else.
That's a really good tip right there for the listeners. Above $500,000 for the median home price. Otherwise, it's just not even worth it.
I'd be a little picky, a little facetious. You might see me come back and I might do a development deal where the median home price is 400. But generally speaking, yeah, if you're in a market where the median single family home price is like 300, 350,000, there is not a huge value prop for manufactured housing. Mm. And it is a ton of work and a ton of risk. And you put a ton of dollars in the ground to develop the infrastructure. I wouldn't mess around with development there.
It's good to know. Thank you for that. Daniel, what does the perfect mobile home park look like in your eyes and why?
I love that question. That is such a niche question because, you know, when you talk to me, I definitely have my my Garden of Eden mobile home park in the sky. You know what? I'm going to pick one of our mobile home parks.
Let's hear it.
It is Terramar Estates in Edgewater, Florida.
Close to my house.
Yes. there is a fishing dock. And when you go out in that fishing dock, you see dolphins, you see manatees, see sea turtles, you see incredible bird life. That's my happy place. We've got two swimming pools there. Just like a wonderful, serene place to live. And, you know, we charge very affordable rents to our residents there. They own their own home and they live in peace and security in a quiet community with all this natural life around them. That's what, of all of our parks, that's the one I would move into.
That's fantastic. Was that one you bought that was like a value add deal, or was that?
Yeah, we bought that about a year and a half ago, and we are still improving it, actively improving it.
Awesome. Very cool.
How about you? What's your fantasy mobile home park?
Man, fantasy mobile home park, if there is such a thing. You know, I would say it would have to be in a market, right, with like over 500,000 median home price and be, you know, 200 lots with, you know, curb and gutter, paved off street parking, you know, direct build utilities. And then, you know, when I buy it, it's like, you know, 70% occupied. So there's a little meat on the bone there after we take it over. So, pie in the sky dreams.
I love that. Keep looking. Someday you may find it. Actually, you probably already found it. Have you found that park yet?
Not that one that's that big, but we found some other ones that are really good in those, you know, Midwestern secondary markets, not the 500K median home price markets, but yeah, we're still looking. Daniel, tell us about your worst performing trailer parks in your portfolio and why you think the NOI has been dragging.
Good question. So we operate around 80 parks and we have around 10 of them on our SWAT list that we need to monitor very actively. And let me think, the one that I think I'm most concerned about. Oh, here's a good example. Puyallup River RV Park. This is a park that is outside Seattle. Very strong housing market, tons of demand for affordable housing, not enough supply. We bought it from an owner who had neglected it in 2019. When we bought it, there were literally people cooking meth, shooting up drugs with syringes, prostitution, all the things. We got them out of there, which I'm very proud of because I wanted to make it a community that I'd be happy to live in. And I think people seeking affordable housing deserve safety and quality. Quite interesting. They have the drug dealers who we were evicting went to the media and talked about how we are mean landlords, evicting low-income people. And so stories came out about how we were doing the wrong thing when in fact we were totally doing the right thing. Anyways, that is the park where we were doing a hands-on turnaround. COVID happened. Like a lot of tenants, like I said, stuck around for 18 to 24 months without paying us rent. We got into financial problems. Those rules have now lifted, so we're now able to move out our non-payers, but we just suffered with really flat occupancy, really struggled with occupancy to the point where I was still worried, are we going to be able to, you know, make our mortgage payments? And this is a case of a manager not being focused enough on occupancy and worrying about all the other things. And we had a conversation about 2 months ago saying, hey, this thing's on fire, right? Red flag, red flag. We are 40% vacant. We need weekly occupancy targets and a weekly check on how many leads have you gotten this week? How many showings? How many applications? How many converted? How do we follow up? And once we set that cadence and got that manager focused, it's amazing the traction we're getting. We're climbing, with three new move-ins a week. So I happily have, I think, the beginnings of a turnaround story at this property, but we're still not out of the woods. And this has been our worst performing property across the portfolio.
Out of the 10 that are on that SWAT list,
yeah,
is there anything in common, like across all 10 of those that you're like, ah, that was the thing, you know? Like for us, for example, Daniel, like we have probably three or four, and they just have like really high turnover, like tenant-owned homes, high tenant-owned home turnover, high park-owned home turnover, and you know, like there's different reasons for that we can get into, you know, like age of home being older, high utility costs, because there's some like, you know, unique scenarios with like, you know, propane instead of natural gas and things like that. But it's high turnover. And that's like it's eating away at our cash flow. because it's like, you know, the CapEx to reinvest into the vacant homes, to rehab them and get them sold again. So that's like one thing that's been consistent for us that we're looking at is like, hey, like, you know, when we're buying new parks, hey, what's the turnover been like? You know, how long has this tenant been here? But I'm just curious on your 10, is that something similar or is it other problems?
So the specific problems really vary. Some of these are in tertiary markets. Some of them are in prime urban markets like Los Angeles County and like outskirts of Austin. Some of them are new products. Some of them are old product. Some of them are MH. Some of them are RV. So I don't think there's a specific problem. But if I were to find a common thread, this is kind of philosophical, is that in all these cases, things are happening that we didn't predict, right? In all these cases, we failed to have a crystal ball to predict the future, and we're now dealing with unexpected problems. If I go back in time, the way to minimize the risk of the unknown is to buy stabilized performing properties where there's a very clear path about what's going to happen, right? So all these had some value add dimension. They all had different types of value add dimension, but that all involved risk and uncertainty. And now we're in the realm of the unknown. And when we've bought stabilized properties, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, if you want a stabilized property, you're going to get stabilized returns, right? You're not going to get the value add returns. So there's risk there. You're taking a chance. So that makes sense. Last couple of questions. What do you think is the biggest threat to mobile home park investing?
Regulatory risk. I'm on the front lines of this. We haven't even talked about what I'm doing in California, where we own two parks that are subject to municipal rent control. And I have several lawsuits and arbitrations going in order to ensure that we as property owners can get a fair return on our investment as guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. So I'm dealing with rent control. I see how destructive it is, how much discord it sows between landlords and tenants. Like, in our 78 other properties, we don't have issues with our residents. We provide a high quality service and we charge a fair rate for it. And our residents are happy. And if they're not happy, they can sell their house and move on. And someone else is very happy to buy their home and pay our fair rents. And it's only at these two properties where we're dealing with rent control that government has distorted the relationship between the landlord and the tenant and is telling us, sorry, Daniel, your costs are going up like this, but you're only allowed to charge this much. You can't earn a return on your capital. I'm sorry. So that's rough. And I think in many jurisdictions, there's risk of new rent control laws getting passed, which I think is misguided. And I think will ultimately lead to no new supply getting built and existing mobile home parks getting converted to other land uses. So that's what I perceive as the biggest risk.
I think that's really accurate. Yeah. I mean, we own one property in the state of New York, and it's a very similar issue, right? You're limited on what you can do in terms of increases. You know, submetering water sewer is this huge deal where you're trying to hold people accountable for the amount of water they're using. And then there's the collections issue where there's three tenants that haven't paid since we bought the place 2.5 years ago. And the judge just keeps kicking the can down the road.
Okay, good. It's not just me who's dealing with tenants who haven't paid rent in 24 months.
Yeah.
Okay, you've got tenants who haven't paid rent in 30 months.
Yeah, it's just a recurring theme, right? And it's definitely changed our buying criteria, right? We got this at like, it seemed like a really steal of a deal. We're like, okay, this is great. But yeah, it just doesn't make sense, right? They're not going to reduce our property taxes for the amount of, you know, past due rent that these tenants are not paying. So definitely, you know, avoiding, you know, some blue states moving forward. But thank you for that. Daniel, thank you for just coming on the show again and revisiting. It's awesome to watch your growth. I know you have a newsletter on LinkedIn that's super informative, and I highly recommend, you know, all the listeners check that out. But if any of the listeners would like to get a hold of you, Daniel, what would be the best way for them to do so?
ThreePillarCommunities.com. And you'll see a button you can click to sign up for our newsletter and our email list. That's the best way to keep up with us and also see our upcoming investment opportunities if you are an accredited investor.
Awesome. And we'll put that in the show notes so that you can have that easily there. What's one last bit of important advice you would give an interested passive mobile home park investor before we sign off?
I don't want to give advice, man. and I don't mean that as a cop out. I mean, I'm at a point in life where trying to do my best, know what I know what I don't know. I don't want to tell people what to do. Do your homework. invest in people who you think are trustworthy and you think are going to do what they say they're going to do, right? Who are credible and will stand by their word, and look for a track record and people who admit their mistakes.
It's good. Thank you, Daniel, for coming on the show.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
That's it for today, folks. Reminder for you to please leave a review if you got value out of this show. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Hey, are you getting value out of this show? If so, would you mind please going over to iTunes and leaving the show a quick 5-star review? I have a goal of hitting over 100 5-star reviews by the end of 2021, and it would mean the absolute world to me if you could help contribute to that. Thanks ahead of time for making my day with your 5-star review of the show.